It's hard to find the right word to describe Henry David Thoreau. Writer.
Philosopher.
Iconoclast.
He's a rebel.
Hermit. None of them are quite right, but Thoreau's own precise descriptions are paying dividends. He wrote Walden, a famous book about living a simple life in harmony with nature. He also studied nature and kept meticulous notes.
Now, scientists are using Thoreau's records to look at how the landscape has changed over the last 150 years. NPR's Nell Greenfield-Boyce has more.
Charles Davis is a biologist at Harvard University who has to admit that he's never actually read Walden.
Bits and pieces, but I'm kind of embarrassed to say that I've actually never read thoroughly through the seminal work, so I'll have to plead my ignorance there.
He got intrigued with Henry David Thoreau for a different reason. He says a couple years ago, he heard a talk about research by two scientists at Boston University, Richard Primack and Abraham Miller Rushing. They had been poring over the notes that Thoreau kept as he explored the area around Concord, Massachusetts. For years, Thoreau walked through fields, woods, and wetlands, jotting down exactly when each flower bloomed, when birds came and left. Davis says he really was an amazing naturalist.
So there's a tremendous body of data that, for the most part, had been unmined. And that was basically the efforts of the Boston University researchers that were involved with the project.
And the Boston scientists were also able to look at the current state of Thoreau's old stomping grounds. Davis says even though modern-day Concord has shopping malls and highways, around half the land hasn't been developed.
It's been very well protected over the last 150 years. So it really is sort of a living laboratory.
And there have been dramatic changes in that living lab.
Something like 25% of the species that Thoreau saw you can no longer see in the Concord area today.
And Davis says another 36% are now so rare that scientists think they're on the way out too. In the current issue of the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, Davis and his colleagues say it looks like the plants that are declining can't adapt to a changing climate. Weather records show that around Concord, the average yearly temperature has gone up a few degrees Fahrenheit over the last century. And the researchers found an interesting pattern. The plants that are declining seem to be the plant families that can't change their blooming times in response to changing temperatures.
So those include things like, you know, the orchid lineage, the buttercups and some of their relatives, roses, some of the aster groups, lilies and their relatives.
He says if plants always flower at the same time of year, they may go out of sync with pollinators that are responding to climate changes. David Inouye is a conservation biologist at the University of Maryland. He says biologists have data going back centuries for some individual species, like cherry trees in Japan. But what's unusual about this study in Massachusetts is that it looks at how different members of an entire plant community respond to changing conditions.
Thoreau would probably be both pleased that his data have had such enduring value and perhaps pleased that people are learning enough about these problems to be able to think about how we may be able to help prevent not just local extinctions, but global extinctions from occurring.
But Thoreau might not be pleased to learn what's been lost from the woods around Walden Pond. Nell Greenfield-Boyce, NPR News.
Both presidential candidates talk a lot about weaning America off foreign oil and adopting alternative energy. Well, here in California, that is already happening. Utility companies pay people who produce solar energy and then send the excess energy back to the grid. How much these companies pay, though, is the subject of some dispute. Rachel Miro of member station KQED reports.
This is for you.
The 2007 Sauvignon Blanc on the house at Cade Winery's grand opening in Napa Valley. Sipping a glass, green building consultant Bill Worthen stands on the patio overlooking neat rows of grapevines and thinks big thoughts about the future.
Green building is a step in the right direction, and now we need to move toward truly sustainable design of regenerative structures, and that's kind of the next step, and that's where net zero energy comes into play.
Net zero means the building generates as much energy as it uses by design, and Cade is a case study, one of the first net zero wineries in the nation. Built entirely out of concrete, steel, and glass, Cade doesn't need any air conditioning, a notable feat in hot, sunny Napa Valley. But even a winery built to minimize electricity usage has to use some juice. Which is why there are solar panels on the roof. This wouldn't be the biggest solar array at a Napa winery, but Worthen says Cade's could have been bigger.
So now, if you'll notice, the size of the array is only half the size of the roof. The roof was about twice as big as what they needed to get their power bill to run back to zero. And the way the current structure is set up for ratepayers, PG&E will not give you a check back for power that you generate on your site.
Can you, say, out of the goodness of your heart, give them the extra energy?
Well, given the hundreds of thousands of dollars that it would cost to put in this extra solar array, I mean, I suppose you could, but what incentive would there be, even when somebody's heart is in the right place, to do such a thing?
Actually, PG&E does pay, but it's a complicated business, and the utility doesn't pay enough to make it worth the bother, Worthen says. He wants the state to require utilities to pay more for the extra energy. That, he figures, would encourage more solar-powered utility customers to reduce their energy usage in order to generate extra for the grid. It's not so simple, says the regulator in charge of solar for the state's Public Utilities Commission, Molly Sterkel.
We already have three incentives for consumers. We have the upfront California Solar Initiative incentive.
First, the utility covers about a fifth of the cost of the installation. For some commercial projects, you're talking about several hundred thousand dollars.
We exempt consumers from interconnection charges or fees or studies.
There's another few thousand dollars. Then, once everything is up and running, solar customers may never have to pay another power bill. When the sun is shining and they feed energy into the grid, the utility credits their account at a generous rate. When the sun's not shining, they pull energy off the grid and the credit offsets the cost. That's an awfully rich, ratepayer-financed set of subsidies, says consumer advocate Mindy Spatt of the Utility Reform Network.
The subsidies under the Million Solar Roofs program are largely going to some of the wealthiest zip codes in California. At the same time, working families in California are struggling to pay their electric bills.
But solar advocates in California say premium rates for customers like Cade that have extra solar to sell would take the state's solar portfolio from respectable to stellar. Germany began offering rich rates in 2000, and now the cloudy European nation boasts more than half the world's solar power generating capacity. More than three dozen nations have followed Germany's lead. The U.S. Congress and five other states are considering doing the same, all of which drives Spatt nuts.
Don't compare us to Germany. Germany also actually has social programs that will protect people when they're unemployed. There's child care. There's health care. So maybe the consumers in Germany can afford to subsidize solar because, in fact, they're already getting all those services. But here we're on our own, you know?
Not all consumer advocates agree with Spatt. Some see the growth of solar in all its forms, big and small, public and private, is a good thing for power grid stability. For NPR News, I'm Rachel Miro in San Francisco.